Welcome back to Homegrown and a Happy New Year.
You too, Miss Wishy. I am Bob Hill. I was last year.
And you'll still be this
most
year?
Most of this year.
Good. I'm planning on that.
Until the Homeland Security folks find me. I may have to go something different.
Bob Hill for another 2008.
Got to open beyond that.
Yeah, really.
I got things to do, lady. I can't.
I know. So do
way
I.
Way too much to do.
So do I. But yes, indeed, Happy New Year and welcome back to Homegrown.
It's good to be here and good to be with you.
Yes, and good to be with you as well. And thanks to our listeners for being with us. Today on the show, Kathy Stokes Schaefer, a landscape design person who's offering up some good tips so that you don't make those same old mistakes that they made back in the 50s by sticking meatballs in front of homes smack against the foundation.
That's more specific. Actually, we're going to talk mostly about front yards and how to design that curb appeal thing people talk about. Mm-hmm. Not just for selling, but, you know, you like to look good in your neighborhood.
For yourself, too, like looking out your window and seeing
what's
a pretty landscape as opposed to only seeing it when you look at your house when you get the mail.
Yeah. And if you think your front yard's got the blahs, then get out your pencil and take some notes because she's got some really good ideas. She's going to be at the Sense Show in Ohio.
Which is an industry show,
but
they usually get very good. You know, for obvious reasons. If it's an industry show, you're going to get, you know, the best of the best. Mm-hmm. So she's got some great ideas.
Interesting stuff. And then, of course, photography is something I'm kind of low mediocre as a photographer, and I want to get better. And we have a man who's really, really good at explaining.
Really, really good.
It's four reelies now.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
It is amazing. Ian Adams, environmental photographer,
right.
Meaning that he takes pictures of, you know, like outdoor stuff, basically. He had written a book for Timber Press several years ago, The Art of Garden Photography.
Right.
So he's offering up some really great information in terms of, you know, how to get the best possible photo of your garden, you know, time of day, types of settings and aperture and all that stuff that you need to do to get the best possible shot. Because it is a little bit of a different sort of thing than just taking snaps of your friends.
I mean, yeah, he deals with fear of photography. There was fear of flying here a few years back. And how to get over that? That a lot of the modern cameras, or the digital cameras, will do a lot for you. But
you still got to know.
You can do that.
Yeah, like he says in his book, the first thing you need to do is like know your equipment.
Right.
So like if you did get a new camera for Christmas this year or whatever, or planning on getting a new one, read the directions. I think that's maybe the thing that most people don't do, Bob.
I won't.
Know how to use what you got, basically. So that's coming up today on Homegrown. Yeah. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I was really, you know, I'm into ferns here lately. It's one of my latest crazes. I was really surprised, happy, and pleased to learn that I've got some out there in my infernary, I call it, that are still bright green.
Yeah.
We've been through the frosts, and my magnolia trees are above it, and the leaves have fallen down, and they're kind of gray and brown on top of the...
Mm-hmm.
But here, poking through these things are these crisp,
nice
green fern leaves. Now, some have kind of melted away, but that was really neat. I didn't know ferns would hang in that much.
Yeah, you think that they're going to be much more delicate, but some of them are pretty tough.
Some are. And boy, it's just such a nice picture, so to speak, these green above the brown.
Right.
The other thing, you know, I've kind of gotten away from the house. I walk up in the Charlestown State Park a lot and talk.
Right, in the wintertime, I
love
that you do that.
And I just recommend people do that. Get away from the house and go out in the woods and look at a beech tree bark in the winter.
It's beautiful.
Or the sycamore bark in the winter, that white bark high up above. I've come across some hornbeams that are that muscle wood.
The muscle wood, I think they call them in the woods.
So I walk along the creek and I see these beautiful gray beech and these white sycamores and the muscle wood, and it's just silence. I can shut my eyes and sit down on the log, and man, that's just so nice to do that. We need to do that. We need to get away from...
Kind of going back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, too, I think, just enjoying that winter landscape, the bones of it all, the skeleton of it all. You see a great deal with
much
the foliage
gone.
Than you might suspect.
Especially the barks and the knobby nature of some things and the little whorls. And unfortunately, there's also some invasives up there. There's a lot of wild grapevines. But they make some interesting, you know, they'd be like 4 inches thick, curlicuing up into the trees.
Yeah.
Anyway, what the wish you state? What's up?
Well, I was knocking around and along the garden path the other day and came across a salamander.
Oh, no.
A couple of years ago, remember I found that salamander in the garage at night, taking the garbage out. And I was like, holy smokes, what is this? I thought it was like an escaped baby alligator because they're big. And finally found out what it was. So now that I know what they are, you know, it was an easy ID. And, of course, straight away I picked it up so I could, you know, ran to the side door and yelled in the house, Andy, come here and look at this.
You bonded with a salamander.
Well, I just wanted him to see it because they disappear pretty quickly. It's unusual, honestly, to see them. And then I put her back, safely.
Sure it was a her?
Most probably it was, yeah. They say, well, not positive, but likely it was.
Was it the earrings or gave her away or sweater?
Yes, it was the skirt. It was the pearl necklace she was wearing that was so dainty and nice.
Okay.
But they're about 8 inches long, kind of beefy. Do you know what I mean? Like kind of robust, soft or smooth, I should say, glistening, kind of camouflagey patterns.
Yeah.
This particular one is an Eastern tiger salamander, which is probably the most common. But again, common in terms of they're there, but we don't see them because they're ground dwellers.
Right.
Underneath stuff in little, in the tunnels and stuff. But you'll see them moving around in like spring. So it's a little early to see one, but it was kind of a warmish day. But usually they move because they're amphibians, so they have to mate in the water. But then when she's finished mating and laying her eggs down by the lake, she'll come back up to the house probably. And she eats snails and slugs and maybe little mice, that sort of thing. So when you see one, be glad because it's a rare sighting. Just because they don't show themselves. And if they're eating slugs and snails and mice, definitely something you want in the garden.
And if you need some other tips on what's dwelling in your garden, Udell Gardens has a series of four events coming up, actually. Dr. Paul Capiello, one of the great teachers around, is going to have a four consecutive Wednesday evening classes, January 9th, 16th, 24th, and 31st. Called the Garden Geek Lecture Series. He's going to talk about just the plant world
stuff,
in general,
yeah.
Flower biology, mm-hmm. pollination, cross-pollination. Mm-hmm. The classes are kind of based on Charles Darwin's work, so it should be interesting. And if you're a garden geek or not, this is a great way to spend four evenings in January.
Indeed. So, yeah, check out their website or go to our website at wfpl.org for more detailed information on that. Also coming up, another great person, also somebody else who's been on Homegrown, like Dr. Capiello. But Michael Pollan is going to be in Louisville for the Kentucky Author Forum.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, we interviewed him back in September. If you want to listen to that interview, you can check out our audio archive for September 23rd, or you can show up with ticket in hand. Of course, you do have to get tickets for the Kentucky Author Forum. It is down at the Kentucky Center for the Arts, and it's going to take place on Friday, January 11th. And it, they've got sort of a wine and cheese event first at 5. Michael Pollan interviews at 6. There's a book signing at 7, some other festivities. So you can check out our website at wfpl.org. You can go to Kentucky Center, all kinds of stuff to get more information on the Kentucky Author Forum.
Very topical because you can talk. He talked about ethanol and corn production
through the omnivore's dilemma.
What we're all dealing with now.
Right. So he'll be talking about omnivore's dilemma and then also his forthcoming book, In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. So should be good. He's a fabulous author. Should be a great interview. Looking forward to having him in town as well.
Another dilemma gardeners often face is how to design the front yard.
It is indeed. What to do, how to look good, and Kathy Stokes Schaefer has some ideas for us.
Kathy, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, it's always interesting. You've got an academic background in landscape design that's matched with a degree in fine arts. Talk about those two and the relationship and what kind of led you down that garden path, so to speak.
Well, the fine arts was really textile design, where you're working with pattern. And I think that's a good fit in with landscape design, because if you're like a bird looking down on the landscape, you're looking at patterns and how these patterns interact with each other and connect like puzzle pieces. So I think that works as a connection. And then my mother just loved gardening, and I got the love of gardening from her.
That's a great way to put it, a bird looking down. I never thought about that
in
those exact words like that.
Because you're not a bird. Maybe why?
I'm an albatross.
Well, we get these patterns often from the architectural aspects of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if you look at the architecture, you want to repeat something that's in the architecture and lay it down into the flat scape,
mm-hmm.
The hardscape of the landscape if at all possible.
But I guess for a really good garden to sort of evolve or be designed, you have to take patterning beyond just your average pattern, if you will, in terms of repetition. So, you know, where does the true creativity come from in terms of pattern?
To backtrack, actually repetition is one of the design principles.
Mm-hmm.
So you should have some of that in your garden, but I agree with you, you don't want it to be so repetitious that it's not interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to go back to good garden design and the creativity part of it is putting all the layers and the pieces parts together. So that's looking at the house, it's creating a landscape that works with the house and also creates a functional, usable space mm-hmm. that you can have an activity in. And when you're dressing up the front of the house, so many people think of foundation planting rather than thinking of utilizing that space in a positive, interesting way. And so depending upon the needs of the family, you create that space between the front of the house and the curb to fit the needs of the family. If you've got a lot of kids, maybe you have to have a play space. Or you might want a sitting space that would be nice to sit out front and just enjoy a different part of your property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, does that process begin by literally standing in the front of the house with the clients in the street and taking notes? How would someone begin?
Well, that's how I don't necessarily stand with a client, but I do stand out at
okay.
the front, and I do take photographs from all different angles. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that so often when you look down a street, each landscape looks the same.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing that stands out that of interest. So with jazzing up your front entry and working with the front of your house, you want people to go by and say, oh, wow, is that beautiful? And the other thing I think that you want to create is that when you come home and you're in your driveway and you get out of the car, either you or a guest, and you leave the driveway and enter a front walk, you want to enter this feeling of that you're leaving the world behind and you're entering your own personal space. And the walk up to the front door should be interesting, not only visually, but touch all your senses. And it should say something about the people who live in the house. So you're bringing your personality out into the garden or that space in the front of the house.
Well, something else you touched on earlier was that like a playground in front of the house. Traditionally, all that stuff is hidden behind the house these days, and you know, this barren landscape in the front yards. Do you consider putting architectural features like fountains or even swings in the front yard?
I don't necessarily think swings in the front yard, but definitely fountains. And like I said, as you're walking up to the front door or anything, I want to touch all the senses. So you either have a focal point of a fountain or a piece of sculpture or even a beautiful plant. And one of the things that I when I teach, I talk about is that what are you looking at when? So when you're walking up toward the front door, what are you looking at? Are you looking down the street at every other house down the street, or is there a beautiful tree and planting that holds your eye? And as you walk up to the front door, does the walk lead you into the front door so you know exactly where you're going? And then when you're leaving the front door and you open the front door, what are you looking out the front door or out your front windows? Often the time you're looking across
right.
the street
mm-hmm.
at somebody's driveway or garage door or something. So I pull plantings further out into the yard to create views and vistas that you're looking
from
at
inside
that are nice from inside the house.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like
we're inside the house so much of the time
mm-hmm.
and the windows frame our views out, and they should be interesting to look at.
So, Kathy, do you feel like people are breaking away from that the old format of only foundation plantings against the house and sort of this bleak and realizing that landscape and interest does need to be pulled out a little bit so they can enjoy it as
yes,
well?
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I think a lot of that, believe it or not, I think stems from a lot of the makeover TV shows and mm-hmm. the curb appeal
oh,
shows.
Yeah.
I think more people are becoming aware of that, plus many of your garden magazines talk mm-hmm. about putting together good design and creating spaces and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think the public is much, much more aware of
good design principles, I guess.
Landscape.
Yeah. You talk about, you know, creating something interesting that reflects a person's personality or, you know, whatever, with their home, ghosts with the home. I've always sort of had a chip on my shoulder about, you know, maintaining the architectural integrity of a home, you know, whether it's an old home or a new home, but just, you know, kind of be consistent within that and not mix too many things up. Are there specific types of design principles, I guess, for garden design that can complement different styles of architecture a little better than others might?
There are no, I guess, hard and fast rules or rules mm-hmm. that are written down about that. So it's really up to each person's creativity. Mm-hmm. But I do think that you want to keep the integrity of your architectural style of the house. You know, if you have a very modern house, you're certainly not going to put a Williamsburg garden in front of a modern house.
Right.
You're going to make something that's mm-hmm. much more unique and angular or have fantastic, like a weeping white pine or something that's very structural that would really kind of offset that modern architecture. Mm-hmm. The other way I try to connect the garden with the landscape is to pick up a color of trim on the house or a color on the house mm-hmm. and utilize that again in the floral, in the flowers or whatever that would be in the landscape that surrounds that area.
Now, do we get too hung up on balance, front yard, right corner dogwood, left corner flowering crab, because you need one on each side like that? Is that still one of the, not rules, but one of the too much we stick with?
Yes. I don't think everything has to be symmetrical, even though you're not using a dogwood and a dogwood. I think people think trees on the corners frame the house, but
right.
you don't have to be the same. And you can pull trees further out into the yard that then also enhance and balance with the house. One of the other things that's very, very important is, one, to do layering. Because in nature we have tall trees, understory trees, which are maybe our flowering dogwood, crab apples kinds. Then we have
right.
the shrubs, and then we have the herbaceous layer below, mm-hmm. which is sort of your perennials, ground covers. And so when you create a design, you want to repeat these layers in your design. So depending if you have a two-story house, you'll start with the tall shade trees. But if you have a one-story house, you might start with the understory trees and whatnot. And then the next thing that you want to make sure that you do with your plant material and putting things together is to make sure you have textural differences in the plant. So if you have a needled evergreen like a yew, mm-hmm. you might want to have something that has a bigger foliage like a viburnum type, because one shows off the wonderful features of the plant next to it.
Okay.
And if people don't like their landscapes, it's because there's not enough textural difference. And
right.
putting the textures together is what can create a really exciting planting plan and make it 10 times much more interesting.
Now, do you think also about the flow of the seasons, you know, the daffodils, the viburnums, the crab apples, the daylilies, and then is that part of the front yard design also?
Yes. Because I think you don't want everything evergreen because it doesn't change with the seasons. And we
right.
live in a zone where we do have changes. You know, we have winter. Things fall, leaves fall off. So you want to have some things that are deciduous. Sometimes the branching structure of a shrub or a tree is just beautiful in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And that adds, again, interest to the landscape. And then you want to plan for fall because you don't want everything to have red foliage in the fall. You want some things to have yellow foliage so that it shines up against the red foliage. And so I think you should have things that change with each season. And you could have one color scheme in the springtime with bulbs and early perennials, and then it could change to a different color scheme in the summertime, and you could even have another color scheme in the fall just by using perennials that might bloom at different times.
And I like the thought of having architectural features in the front yard, like a fountain. You don't see them much in the front yard. They're always in the back. What other features might you have, you know, hardscape like that would improve a front yard's appearance?
Well, sometimes fencing the yard looks very attractive. Sometimes if you don't want to fence the yard, you could still have an arbor as an entryway into your front yard garden space, right, which could be very beautiful.
Right.
And today I look at the architecture of the house, and maybe a front porch might be nice, or just an area over the door so that if you're coming in, you at least aren't being rained on when someone's trying to find the key or they're waiting for you to come open the door if they're a guest. And then I've also seen people create seating areas with lattice above that could be incorporated into the architecture and to give another usable space that you could enjoy the front of your house.
One other thing I'm thinking about, with a really bold front yard in a neighborhood of otherwise barren green grass, are the homeowners sort of intimidated to try this because it's just so unique to the whole neighborhood? People are going to wonder if they're crazy?
Yes and no. I think when you're looking at your house as a whole, you want it to be beautiful and to really stand out in a positive way. I've done something in my house that the neighbors haven't done, and I've put a garden on either side of the sidewalk.
Oh.
So as when people come down the sidewalk, they're walking through my garden. And the kids love it, and the people who walk down the block love it. And so I've found that I don't mind my garden standing out, I guess.
No, I'm with you.
Because it gives pleasure to so many people other than me. So I guess I don't worry about that. I guess you don't want it too garish and too so unique that it's more of an eyesore rather than a beautiful attraction.
But your backyard is stone ugly, right?
I seriously doubt that.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much. Enjoyed it, and you've been very helpful to us.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Kathy Stokes Schaefer has a landscape design company in Strongsville, Ohio called Garden Graphics. For more information on Kathy or her company, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, Ian Adams and the Art of Garden Photography. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
So, Bob, did you get a new fancy digital camera for Christmas this year?
I'm still working on my old fancy digital camera.
Me too, actually. Learning all the buttons.
Yeah, I'm eager to learn because I've got so many, just hundreds of thousands of great pictures out there.
Yeah.
I'm always entranced by good photography because I've been in places standing side by side with a really good photographer shooting the same thing.
And yours looks like...
Yeah. Well, not quite, but
okay,
close to it. It's nowhere near as good and crisp and clear as the guy who knows what he's doing.
Well, you know, that's the case with
many
things.
And I'm right there next to him. It ain't right.
Well, I think that we're going to be blessed with the very good information today. Ian Adams is joining us.
Ian Adams is an environmental photographer from Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, whose photographs have been used in Fine Gardening, Family Circle, Horticulture, Midwest Living, and Organic Gardening magazines, among others. He's also been published in many garden books and gives many workshops and talks on landscape and garden photography, including a talk at the upcoming Sense Garden Show in Columbus, Ohio. But today I'll be mostly talking about how to photograph plants in your yards. Ian, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Yeah, we're always curious about the history of people, why they do what they do, and how long they've been doing it. So talk about your background as a photographer and what led you in that direction.
Well, I made a transition from corporate America to freelance photography about 18 years ago. So I started off as a self-taught nature photographer and then graduated into becoming more and more of a garden photographer, at least during the warm months when things are growing outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you a plant person before that, or you just kind of evolved the two together?
Only in the sense that I've always enjoyed wildflowers and nature. Mm-hmm. And okay. Since the techniques are very much the same for nature photography and garden photography, it was very easy for me to make a switch. I also found that a lot more people were willing to actually pay me to go and photograph gardens rather than photograph nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, imagine. And your web's listed specifically as environmental photography. Talk about that as opposed to maybe shooting people or buildings or something like that.
Well, Bob, most photographers shoot one or more of three things, either products, places, or people. I'm a places photographer primarily.
Okay.
And I'm very subject-driven. I find subjects that fascinate me, like barns and covered bridges and waterfalls and rural America and gardens, and then I tend to get very absorbed with them and photograph them. So I there's about a dozen subjects that I generally photograph, and the common thread that they share is that they're all outdoor subjects of one kind or another, mm-hmm. usually in natural or horticultural or historical sites, too. I very much enjoy photographing historic buildings and rural architecture, barns and covered bridges and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, I know that we want to learn some good tips on how to do some decent photography of plants and landscapes.
Let's start with what camera do I use, Ian?
Sure. I would say 9 out of 10 people that come to my seminars and workshops in garden photography are now using digital cameras, Bob. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So very, very few people are using film, although film still gets the job done. But I think there are many advantages, not only instant feedback, but all of the things you can do in terms of sharing your garden photographs if you use a digital environment. So my recommendation would be to purchase either a compact, often called a point-and-shoot camera, my real recommendation is a single-lens reflex. 2 years ago, you would have had to spend well over $1,000 to get a single-lens reflex camera that was any good. Now you can get one with a very high-quality lens capable of professional garden photography results for about $500.
So what does single-lens reflex mean?
Single-lens reflex is simply, they look like the old film cameras, and mm-hmm. they allow you to use interchangeable lenses. That's
okay.
really the key.
Oh,
yeah. And the other important thing is they have big viewfinders. Mm-hmm. So when you look through the viewfinder, you get a bright, clear picture of the thing that you're looking at.
Gotcha.
One of the problems with compact cameras, point-and-shoots, they're very small and very lightweight, so they're easy to carry around, but they don't tend to have very good viewfinders. Mm-hmm. They have tiny little sensors, so they don't provide the same image quality as SLRs, single-lens reflex, and most of them make it very difficult for you to screw a filter on the end, for example. Mm-hmm. So I tend to recommend single-lens reflex cameras. There's not much price difference between a good, compact, point-and-shoot digital mm-hmm. camera and a low-end single-lens reflex.
So you mentioned lenses as well. Is that something, or not lenses, but filters, is that something that's also important if you want to get a really good image?
Janine, it used to be a lot more important than it is today. In the old days, because of different kinds of film and the different kinds of lighting that you might encounter, mm-hmm. You often had to use a number of different filters, color correction filters, for example. Nowadays, the only filter that you really need to carry when you're photographing a garden is what's called a polarizing filter. Works a little bit like sunglasses. Mm-hmm. It helps to intensify colors. It will make a blue sky a richer blue, and also it will reduce the glare from reflections from the things of like mm-hmm. surfaces of ponds or wet leaves, for example.
Okay.
Well, all of the other filters are available to you as part of the digital software programs like Photoshop that are used to fine-tune digital photographs after you've taken them.
Gotcha.
Okay, so it's Christmas morning. I got my $500 camera, as you described it, a filter. I'm looking out the window. I want to start photographing my yard. What next? Where do you start? How do you think
first thing to do, Bob, is to make sure you understand your camera. So make sure that if you don't read the instruction manual, and unfortunately, digital cameras are complicated beasts, and even the little ones come with 120-page user manuals.
Right.
But most of them come with a little quick start guide, which is usually a fold-out piece of paper. make sure you understand the basics of where all of the basic controls are on the camera. That's really important. You don't want to be fiddling around trying to find out where the on-off switch is when you're out in your favorite garden. Mm-hmm. Second thing I'd suggest is to use a tripod whenever possible. It's very important to do that because it helps you use long shutter speeds. For example, if you have a waterfall or a stream in your garden and you want to get a nice blurred effect of the, in the water, or if you're trying to photograph a scenic photograph where you've got a lot of depth of field from foreground to the distance and you're trying to get everything sharp and you want to use a small f-stop, none of those things are possible if you're trying to handhold the camera. Mm-hmm. So because most things in a garden don't tend to move around like people do at sporting events and things like that, right. Using a tripod's the second piece of advice I would give.
And would you recommend focusing on one plant or a particular area or the whole garden, taking different shots? Where do you begin?
When you're documenting a garden, when I get hired to photograph a garden for a garden designer or for a book publisher, I try to give them a variety of different photographs. I always try to find some overview situations, maybe at ground level, or maybe I have to get up high and shoot from maybe a bedroom window or something like that, somewhere where I can get a bird's eye view which shows most, if not all, of the garden. Usually that requires using a wide-angle lens. And to make those photographs more dramatic, I look for something very strong to put in the foreground. It might be a group of plants. It might be a rock or some sort of structure in the garden, something to lead the eye into the scene. Photo editors call those establishing shots or vistas, and it's important to have one or two of those. Another thing I would be looking for would be different groups of plants in the gardens that are particularly interesting from the point of view of the shapes and the sizes and the colors, for example, and how they've been juxtaposed. And usually the zoom lens that comes with your camera will do a good job in letting you photograph those. And then also, of course, one wants to look for particular plants which are especially beautiful to do perhaps some close-ups of those. So that I'll end up with wide-angle photographs which show the whole garden, some close-ups of different sections of the garden, different design aspects of the garden, and then always some portraits of particularly interesting plant species, for example.
So, Ian, do most of these single-lens reflex cameras also come with the wide-angle capability, or is that something that you would have to put it on a new lens for?
No, usually, Janine, now, when you buy a digital single-lens reflex camera, you buy it with what's called a kit lens. The kit lens is something that's usually, for example, an 18 to 50 millimeter or an 18 to 70 millimeter lens. And at the 18-millimeter setting, it's a wide-angle lens that lets you do those vista shots.
So it has that range capability.
Exactly. It has the range. And you might want to get, for example, a 70 to 200-millimeter lens as a second lens. Those two lenses would then let you do pretty much everything that you would want to do for the most part in a garden.
Okay, so the smaller the number, the wider the
correct.
Angle.
The smaller the number, the wider the part of the scene that it takes in.
Okay, gotcha.
Most of those lenses will usually let you get fairly close so that you can probably do some general plant portraits with those lenses. If you can't focus quite closely enough, say, to fill the frame with just a single plant, you may want to consider buying what's called a macro lens, which is a close-up lens designed for say, plant portraiture. Or you can often buy things called close-up filters, which are very inexpensive, clear glass filters that screw into the end of the lens, which enable you to focus closer. And they're a lot less expensive than special macro lenses.
Ian, my photography, which is mediocre at best, the elephant in the garden is always light. Available light, too much sun, too much shadows. What do you recommend, shooting times, morning, afternoon, or how do you deal with difficult light?
Well, Barb, you're absolutely right. Interestingly enough, one of the pieces of advice I have is to avoid what I call SKOD, which stands for the sunny kiss of death.
Right.
Most people often think that high noon on a bright sunny day is perfect weather for photography, but in fact, for virtually any kind of outdoor photography, bright sunny days are absolutely the worst type of lighting imaginable. The reason is that the lighting is very harsh, and it's not suitable, therefore, for the subject matter of a garden. And secondly, it's very, very contrasty. So it's very, very difficult for the camera to record all of the range between white and black, for example. My favorite light for photographing gardens, if I have to photograph a garden on a sunny day, I get there very, very early, way before sunup, so that I can have the first couple of hours of the day before the sun gets too high, or I work very late in the day at the same time. But my favorite lighting for most garden photography is a cloudy day.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a cloudy day just after a gentle shower of rain, which has wet everything down,
mm-hmm.
is my very favorite mm-hmm. lighting for garden photography. So the key is to try to avoid those bright mm-hmm. sunny days. That's very difficult lighting for most kinds of outdoor photography.
And beyond lighting, what is the biggest mistake or mistakes you see amateurs making that they should try and avoid from the get-go?
Well, for example, with close-ups, a lot of people are not aggressive enough. They don't get close enough to the subject. So you'll see a tiny little plant portrait surrounded by 90% of background. You want to be quite aggressive with a portrait. Fill the frame with the subject. As far as possible. Of course, there are compositional guidelines, things like using, anybody that's been to art class will probably remember things like the rule of thirds, which helps you when you're trying to place subjects. Using leading lines like fences, for example, and things like that. I think not being aggressive enough is one thing that I see with a lot of folks. They're a little wimpy, perhaps, to start with.
Right.
And that's the value, really, of the digital camera, kind of going back to that, is
absolutely.
It allows people to be a little bit more aggressive. You can go back and review and dump the stuff that perhaps you were a little too aggressive with and didn't work out.
You're exactly right.
Without wasting your money on development and such.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have that instant feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of information that you can get after you've taken a photograph with a digital camera that will help you, for example, to make sure that you've got the exposure correct, that it's not too light and not too dark.
Mm-hmm.
By looking at a little graph on the back of a digital camera called a histogram, which most of them provide. In the old days with film, you had to get the film developed to see whether you'd got it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to also trust my automatic switch too much, and I just let the camera decide for me. I guess that's a learning process. How do you get people beyond this automatic to try something different and get off that and experiment a little bit?
It's certainly best not to use automatic. Not to use, for example, automatic focus. I often see photographs where, for example, somebody has taken a photograph of a person and the person is blurred and the background is sharp. And the reason for that is that most autofocus cameras are designed so that the little thing that it focuses on has to be in the middle of the little circle, in the middle of the viewfinder. And if you don't figure that out and then recompose, you know, guess what? The tree is sharp, but the person is not. So,
I have actually learned that, so I know how to actually auto-focus on the right thing.
Yeah. So, you know, unless you have a vision situation where you really need the help of autofocus, I do all of my garden photography manual focus. And there's usually various settings on a digital camera in terms of metering the light. And the one that I recommend for garden photography is the A, or the aperture setting.
Okay.
That means that you set what is called the f-stop. The f-stop is just simply the diameter of the little circle that the light comes through.
Uh-huh.
And the camera picks the shutter speed to get the exposure correct so that it's neither too light nor too dark. So you set the aperture, which is what controls the depth of field in the picture, and it figures out the shutter speed. So the A setting, as opposed to the S setting, shutter speed, which would be great for football games, for example, and other things like that with lots of things moving around,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't use the program setting, which is the P setting on digital cameras, where the camera tries to figure it out both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's kind of like taking your hands off the steering wheel and hoping that everything will be okay when you're driving a car. It's not going to work very well.
Crash.
Have your knees handy.
Yeah.
Well, do you find, like, shooting barns, fences, trees, even wildlife, a different animal than shooting flowers, so to speak?
They're different subjects. And, you know, one of the nice things about most of the environmental subjects that I shoot is that they do tend to be somewhat stationary, barns in particular. But flowers do move around in the breeze, as you know. Nature designed them that way. So you do have to develop the skill of patience. and wait for the wind to die down. And with garden photography, that's great because you can sort of sit there and contemplate the meaning of life for a few seconds or minutes and enjoy the beauty of the garden that you're in. But you do need a bit of patience to wait for the lulls between the wind moving the flowers around.
Mm-hmm. Ian, you know, I always would get frustrated with, like, plant catalogs. And, like, you look at the color that's represented in terms of what plant they're selling, and you're like, that's not the right color.
Right.
I mean, are there ways to achieve the closest, most accurate color and then ways to, you know, pretty much ensure that you're not going to get the right color? Is that something that has to do with the proper lens and filters and such?
This can get a little bit technical, but let me give your listeners a couple of pieces of advice.
Okay.
One of the wonderful things about digital cameras as opposed to film cameras is that they are not only very good at measuring the amount of light, but they're also very good at figuring out what kind of light it is. In other words, whether it's daylight, whether it's sunny, whether it's cloudy, or whether, for example, it's fluorescent light or tungsten light if it's in an artificial situation like shooting Christmas lights. Film cameras can't do that. You had to change your film or use special filters to deal with it. With digital camera, you have a setting on the camera called the white balance.
Right.
And the trick is to leave it set on automatic. Most digital cameras do a great job of figuring out the type of light if you just set the white balance on automatic. And then the time to adjust the color is when you get the digital pictures on your computer in the comfort of your home or office where you can study the light better and decide whether you want to make adjustments to it.
This kind of information just really isn't that available, and you've explained things so well, and we so appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me to join you on Homegrown at WFPL.
Thank you. Thank you,
Ian. You forgot .org.
Yeah.
Ian Adams is an environmental photographer, teacher, and author from Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. For more information on Ian, his workshops, or his website, visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And Bob, we have a couple of questions, and this one's from Susan Salzberg. She says that she lives in the Highlands on a street with narrow lots, no driveways, and an alley that her garage faces. And recently, one of the garages that she has to look at was painted orange with the battleship gray trim, she says, which is something that she doesn't really want to have to look at. So she's asking if we have any recommendations in terms of planting something native that she can put along the property line that's going to grow kind of tall and probably thin, and, you know, relatively fast, so that she doesn't have to get upset every time she looks out her window at the orange garage. Well,
that's a tough, because we don't know the sun shade. It sounds like a shady area, which sort of limits what you can do in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen some arborvitae that were kind of tall and upright, but they would require some sun.
They like a little more sun.
They wouldn't work, and hemlocks and yews can take some shade. Well, hemlock can grow fairly fast, but they're wide.
Not that fast, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you're just talking about a trellis and some vines.
Yeah, nothing's going to grow like super fast that you're going to want back there, so kind of get that perspective on it. And these may be kind of hard to find. Unfortunately, they're native and you can see them everywhere, but I really wish more people would plant just the eastern red cedar, you know, that you see along the highways and all sort of fuzzy. That's can tolerate, in fact, some shade.
Some shade, yeah.
And in terms of growing fast, you know, it's relative.
And they're tougher than nails. They'll grow.
Yeah, but they're just hard to find in the nurseries and stuff. But some nurseries do carry them, especially those that are more committed to native plants. So you can try that at least if you want an evergreen. Otherwise, yeah, building some sort of trellis or learning to like orange.
That's just a tough situation.
Yeah, it really is. All right, another question.
This is from Bernadine Strange, way down in Bardstown.
All right.
Always glad to hear from folks down in Bardstown.
Yep.
I received a royal purple smoke tree for my December birthday. It's a great plant. I love
it
leaving that thing. Pretty large pot. The plant itself was probably 3 feet tall. The nursery cut it back so it fit my daughter's car. Would it be okay to leave it in the house over winter and plant it in spring, or should I try to get it planted outside now before the colder weather sets in?
Definitely do not leave it in the house.
Right.
No.
Right.
It's a, you know, a plant that is acclimated to outdoors. It'll be much harder on it if you have it in the house. If you can't get it planted, Bernadine, it's really not that big of a deal. You just want to make sure that you mulch the pot. I know Bob's probably the same way. Usually at our house, there's quite a few little plants there next to the garage.
Several thousand.
That haven't made it into the ground. And we just, like, throw bags of mulch over top of the containers so that the root system is adequately insulated, yeah, you know, from really cold weather.
Or just put the pot in the ground if you can.
And exactly. And, you know, but if you're going to do that, go ahead and plant it, because if the ground is still workable, not too wet and, you know, not frozen, there's no reason you can't go ahead and get that smoke tree planted now. So cold is relative in terms of what can and can't be planted. It's more of if the ground is frozen. Yeah, so, but definitely don't bring it inside. Get it planted or mulch it and do it in the spring. Not
good.
A big deal.
You bet. If you have a warm weather question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
The arborvitae.
Aha. Uh-huh. There's got to be some interesting information
amazing.
Word like that.
You have another one I didn't realize, and it's kind of confused at times. We just discussed the eastern red cedar or the juniper.
Uh-huh.
Grows along the highway, and people sometimes right. think that's arborvitae. It's not, but they're both called cedar, so there is some competition
that's
there.
The trickiness about yeah. common names.
Exactly. And the arborvitae is, as the cedar, it's kind of soft and resistant to rot at the same time. It's a neat tree.
Mm-hmm.
It does really well, basically, in wet, swampy areas.
Huh.
Thoreau said it was both mossy and moosey. I love that.
That is cool.
Thoreau.
It's descriptive.
It's mostly north of here and in the mountains east of here, but
where it's native to,
yeah.
you mean?
But
yeah.
we have a very common different cultivars landscape in our yards. Yeah, mm-hmm. we'll talk about that in a minute. The name is very deceptively simple, but with a story. Arbor is Latin for tree.
Mm-hmm.
Vitae is for life.
Of course.
It's the tree of life.
Awesome.
Story behind it. It's the first tree that ever went from North America back to Europe.
Oh.
It was taken back home. The reason why. In 1535, a French explorer named Jacques Cartier,
mm-hmm.
family was jewelers, I think, was exploring the St. Lawrence River looking for the Northwest Passage,
right.
weren't they all, had to spend the winter in a fort. The whole crew got scurvy. A local Native American came up and said, hey, take the bark off the arborvitae, the leaves. They did.
Yeah.
You know what's in there?
Vitamin C.
You got it. So he took the concoction back to France, and mm-hmm. King Francis I named it arborvitae, the tree of life.
Ah.
Because it saved the guys
the people on
from
the
scurvy.
Cartier.
Yeah.
Huh.
I never put it together.
Expedition. Very good.
That arborvitae was the northern white cedar, the Latin for that, Thuja occidentalis. Greek Thuja is perfume. Occidentalis, this is cool. It means sunset or from the west.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a perfume tree from the west, at least the west of France.
Right, yeah.
And the other one in our country is the Thuja plicata, which is a much larger tree, the giant western red cedar.
Uh-huh.
I've got those.
Uh-huh.
And plicata means, I didn't know this, to fold or overlap.
Uh-huh.
So the Thuja plicata has folding, overlapping foliage.
And it does,
yeah.
when you say that.
The giant western
mm-hmm.
cedar. It's used a lot in locally in our gardens. I've got several of these myself. A lot of the cultivars, like De Groot Spire,
mm-hmm.
kind of a twisty arborvitae to 20 feet. Emerald Green is a common hedge. You mm-hmm. see it all the time. Techne is a common hedge. Then there's the Golden Globe or Globosa. Obviously, it grows mm-hmm. in a globe shape. And the golden one is a golden one. So it's pretty common in our...
Spring
in our
Grove also is a very
yeah,
nice one from
yeah.
our Spring Grove Cemetery.
And if you have space, and I've got several large arborvitae mm-hmm. hedges, and I just love them, and I like mm-hmm. The needles are cool. Comes with a poem, of course.
Of course.
Consider how great our history, when bark is peeled from a common tree, by native hands of some mystery, and the final result is vitamin C. Taken back home by a French Captain Gruff, who showed his king this magical stuff, who waved his wand all sorcerers to see, and thus was born the arborvitae. The first of our trees to be shipped to the east, the first of many into the maw of that beast, The source of our wars, our stress and our strife, yet also, it must be said, our tree of new life.
Very nice. The arborvitae.
Tree of life.
So yeah, this time of the year, if you can't get a hold of any citrus, just chew on the bark of
arborvitae. And you'll have vitamin C and no scurvy in your house.
There we go. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, the story behind, as a matter of fact, American citrus production and consumption.
Homegrown is produced and photographed by the multi-talented Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.